Thanks, everyone. Appreciate it. I was 28, and I was 2 years into AAC, which is Al-Anon Adult Children, not affiliated with ACA in any way. And I asked my mom, I said, like, I've got this constant anxiety, almost an addiction to it. Do you know anything about that? And she said to me, like, I think I can help you out with that. And she told me that she was 19, pregnant with me. She knew nothing about raising a child. My dad and her had just gotten married, I think, the year before. So everything was brand new. My mom asked my dad's mother for help. And she said, like, what do you do for a baby? And my dad's mom said, well, you don't want a spoiled baby. So you put them in the back room and you just let them cry themselves to sleep. You don't ever, ever go to a baby that's crying, right? So my first 2 years, I was put in the back room to cry whenever I was crying. I do remember stories of my dad putting me in the back of the Mustang. He had a 66 Mustang that I loved. And they would drive me around, and he said that I would fall asleep to that sometimes. So I knew they didn't leave me all the time to cry in the back room, but I know that it's a really big part of the emotional neglect that happened. And Tony A talks about emotional neglect people, that they're just as affected by the neglect as somebody that's abused. And in my feed the other week came up a scientific thing that the part of the brain that emotional neglect, like on an MRI, it lights up the exact same area as if somebody's physically abused. So Tony A is indeed right on that. So that was my first 2 years. My brother came along when I was 22 months. And this is the story I'm told. They brought him home from the hospital on that day, and I was stroking my brother's arm and saying, nice baby, nice baby. And as soon as my parents left the room, I clawed my brother's arm and he started to cry. So somebody had pointed out to me that at 22 months, I had already figured out that there wasn't enough love to go around in the home, and that my little brother was going to take attention away from me from a place that I was already feeling lonely in. I was my brother's abuser for most of his childhood, beating him up. I would hurt him, threaten him, call him names, belittle him. And then eventually he'd bug me back and I'd get angry and then I'd beat him up. He'd phone dad. I'd get on the phone. Dad would yell at me over the phone, but he couldn't yell too loud because he's at work in the office. It was negative attention, but it was still attention for me. And that's what I did. Like, I did whatever I could to get attention, even though I wasn't consciously aware of it at the time. My mom and I had a relationship that was based on my special little guy. Whenever I hear Marge Simpson say that about Bart, I'm just like, oh my goodness, that was our emotionally incestuous relationship. My mom would tell her adult problems to me. And I can remember from 5 to 7, this happening often. And I didn't want to listen, but my mom would have sadness and anger while she's talking. And I'm like, if my mom is this angry right now, if I tell her I don't want to listen, imagine how angry she's going to be if I say I can't listen to her. It was, yeah, not a healthy relationship, but that was the way it was. With my dad, it was interesting because my parents split up, I think, when I was 7 for 10 months. And up to that point, there was spanking, right? It was hard to understand. I remember one incident where my brother and I, we've got a 2.5-story house, and we're riding down the attic stairs. They're really steep, on the hide-a-bed mattress like a toboggan. And my mom comes up the stairs, and she says, like, just wait till your father gets home. And we just laughed and kept riding the mattress down the stairs. And my dad, at the end of work, like when he came home, he races up the stairs and he just like explodes at the top of the stairs, grabs my brother, spanks him. I'm 7, so I'm running around the railing in the middle of the floor. and I'm able to keep ahead of him because I'm in bare feet and he's got socks on. And he says, "You're just making it worse." And I give up. And part of me just hates myself for giving up because I could have avoided it. But there's the logic of, like, he's going to make it worse if I don't give up now. So I took the spanking. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that my mom would give my brother and I up. She actually liked when we got into trouble because she could take my dad's anger from work. He'd be angry, and if we hadn't done anything bad, quote unquote, that day, then she would take the brunt of the anger. So, my mom would give us up. My mom had been raised in a home where her father would just burst in on her and her sister if they'd gone to bed and they were talking at night. He would burst in, beat them, and then just tell them to get to sleep. And my mom, weirdly enough, didn't hate my grandfather for that. She hated my grandmother for watching it happen. But I'm pretty sure my grandmother was the one who took the brunt of the beatings before my mom and her older sister came along. And so they separated for 10 months and they got back together, and it was pretty rocky. Like, my brother and I at 8 and 6 were saying, you know, they just fight all the time. It was actually better when they were apart because at least there wasn't the constant fighting going on. So when they separated the second time, my brother and I chose to go with my dad. We went with my mom the first time, went with my dad the second time. And my mom moved from where I am, 1,200 miles away or 1,700 kilometers to North Vancouver. And so I moved into the position of my mom. And my dad was angry. He'd come home from work and he would yell and scream at me in my face. I'm not sure how many times a week, sometimes once, sometimes four times. It was random, right? And each time I would try and memorize what my dad had said from the last fight, and I would think, oh, if I can say this to him, he'll see the logic in it. And that was my disease. Like, there's fight, flight, freeze, fawn, forget, and float. And I would forget all about the previous argument that there was nothing that made sense. In the moment, there was this, what I call alcoholic logic, and I would be stunned by it, confused, and it was like, oh, wow, he makes a lot of sense. I guess it is my fault. The fights would end with me crying, running to the bedroom. I'd be in there for however long, but I made sure I wasn't loud enough to cry, because if I was loud enough and he heard me, then he would say, I'll give you something to cry about. Those words, that's still a trigger when I hear other people say it. It's like, oh, my goodness. I'll give you something to cry about. And I'm just like, I go into shock. I go into shock still to this day over that phrase. So the Jekyll and Hyde personality of my dad would come out, like angry after work, the yelling. I'd be in there. And then if I was still in the room, he would come in and he'd knock and come in and say, hey, Johnny Carson is on. Do you want to come listen to the monologue? And 9:30 was my bedtime, and in summertime, Johnny came on at 9:30. So I get to stay up a little bit later, watch 10 minutes of the monologue. And then that was kind of what made everything okay. I never talked about it again. I didn't bring it up, didn't say a word about it. This happened from the time I was 8 till the time I was 19. And it was just the insanity of the alcoholic home. It was that merry-go-round of denial, and it just kept the same things. It was Groundhog Day, but in a weird way. And I kept thinking, when I turn 18, I'll be an adult, and I'll magically know everything. I'll be able to leave here, and no one will ever bother me, because the craziness is all at this house right here. So eventually, I did a year of university, and so I stayed at home an extra year willingly. I paid for my own university. It was weird because my dad had done computers. He was making, at some time like in 78, he was making $3,000 a month take home. But yet by the end of the month, like by the third week, we ran out of money. And there'd be no food. other than Kraft Dinner and bologna. And I can't eat bologna to this day, but yet I still love Kraft Dinner, the comfort food kind of thing. One is, yeah, demonized, and the other is still, I had one Kraft Dinner 2 days ago. So it ended in a fist fight. I started it, and my dad was screaming in my face, and I just couldn't take it one more day. And so I got kicked out of my dad's house. My mom had moved back from North Vancouver back into a farm half an hour outside of the city where I moved into. I swore I would never cry in front of my dad again, and I didn't at that fight. And for years, I was just shut down. I was just frozen feelings. Couldn't cry if something was the saddest thing I'd ever seen, like movies, animals, nothing could make me cry. I was 23, that's my cat, Cutie McWhiskers. I was 23 when I was with my girlfriend. We'd go to Buy Right Drugs, and I saw a book on the carousel, and it said, Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I'm like, well, I don't know if I'm an adult child, but my dad's definitely an alcoholic. They had separated the first time because my dad was a weekend drunk. He'd get drunk Friday night at 5 p.m., and remain drunk until Sunday night, midnight, sometimes later. But he was high functioning Monday to Friday, responsible, brought home lots of money, right? So when I saw that book, I looked at it and I was like, I looked at the cover, and three times we had been to Buy Right Drugs, and my girlfriend finally said, would you just buy the book already, right? I would stand there, read it, but never think of buying it, right? So I finally spent the $7.95. And I read the book, except for one chapter. There's a chapter on spirituality, which I thought was religion, and there's no way I was reading that. So I didn't know what spirituality was. I just thought it was religious. So the other crazy thing that the book talked about was going to an in-person meeting. And I'm like, why would I want to do high school all over again? Why would I want to be around people that criticize me and I've got to defend myself? So for three more years, I did the same routine. Just eat, sleep, and work. I didn't have friends per se. I didn't know it at the time. I was a sex addict. So I would get into a relationship. I was 21 the first time I was in a relationship. And from there, I made up for lost time. And I had six or seven different relationships until I turned 26. And the emptiness and the loneliness just ate away at me. Because if I thought I was lonely before I slept with someone, after I slept with someone, I was more lonely than I could have ever imagined. And my heart just ached. But again, frozen feelings. I wasn't crying for anything. And there was a day that came when I thought I was going crazy. Because each of the girlfriends I had been with, all the negative things that they said about me just got on a loop in my brain, and it just went around and around and around. I couldn't stop it. Now, when I was younger, when I was 10, my dad had gone to the hospital for severe depression, and in my area, they still believed that shock treatments were the best way to deal with depression, and you had to be awake, is what they believed. So it was just, yeah, that was the way it was. It was insanity. My brother and I, to deal with the scariness of seeing, like, I never saw my dad in the shock treatments. I only saw the aftermath. So on Wednesday night, my brother and I would tell my dad jokes, and he'd laugh. And then on Thursday night, we'd tell the same jokes again, and Dad would laugh like he had never heard them before because his short-term memory was erased, right? So my brother and I would just look at each other and have that look, that kind of like that knowing, and that was the only way we could deal with the terror. My mom had gone through the in the 90s for depression again. Same hospital, but this time it was, I guess, pharmaceutical. Drugs, antidepressants to work on the depression. And in between those two, from the 70s to the 90s and the 80s, my brother had a manic depressive episode. So when I couldn't stop playing all these thoughts at 26, I thought, well, you know, it's just my time to go to the psych ward. And yeah, it's in the family, and I'm no exception. And I remembered when I was 14. So from the time my mom moved away, from the time I was 9 to 13, I would go out to Vancouver, North Vancouver, and visit her for 2 weeks out of the summer with my little brother. And she had a house, and she had a boyfriend. And back in those days, you could work for something like 72 weeks, quit your job, and then they would pay you unemployment for the next 6 months. And so that's what he did. He just worked long enough to get unemployment for the summer. They grew marijuana in the backyard. There were bikers. My first ride on a Triumph was there. People started coming as soon as Wednesday for the Friday night party, and the party would go from Friday till Sunday. I remember waking up and there'd just be people passed out all over the house. The fact that I wasn't molested in that time was just a miracle. Like, something was looking after me then, right? So, and then came when I turned 14, went out to visit my mom in North Van, and she had moved across to Vancouver, bought a condo, didn't have the same boyfriend, didn't hang out with the bikers, didn't do marijuana, I think she still drank. But the change was so profound, I asked her, like, what happened? Like, what's so different? What happened? And she said, I'm going to Al-Anon. And I don't know if she went for 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. I can't remember. But that was the change. And so when I'm like, well, I better go to the psych ward at 26 because I can't stop playing all these negative thoughts. And I was like, oh, Al-Anon. Maybe I'll give Al-Anon one try. And because I'd read that book on adult children of alcoholics, I thought, oh, I'll go. And maybe there's an adult child meeting. So I went to the Al-Anon office, asked for an Al-Anon adult child meeting because I wanted to look smart. My life is falling apart. I can't manage it, but I want to look smart, like I know what I need to do. Always control, always manage what other people see about me, right? And so the first night I went, it was a Sunday, and I go there, and the church was locked. Of course, it's a church, and I'm like, oh, man, I do not want to go to a church, but I'm desperate. So another lady comes up and I'm like, oh, what can you tell me about Al-Anon adult children? And she's like, I don't know. I'm brand new too. And so we were there for about 10 minutes. And then along comes this old guy, and he's just shuffling along, and he comes up and he's like, oh, so the doors are still locked. And we're like, yeah. Like, do you have a key? And he's like, no, it's only been about 3 weeks since this meeting started. So nobody probably took the key. It happens. Why don't we go across to the restaurant and I'll tell you my story? And so this old guy tells me his story. Well, tells the two of us his story. And I couldn't believe how vulnerable he was with us. Like, I'd never heard anyone talk like that before. Like, in my family, we kept secrets. If I told somebody, it wasn't supposed to go to somebody else. We had triangles, but don't talk to this person. This side of the family shouldn't know. Your cousin can't know. Your grandma can't know, whatever it was. And this guy is telling us everything about him. And I'm just like, I couldn't believe it. So that was what actually got me to come back, because if he hadn't have come along, I would never have gone back. I would have just gone to the psych ward and checked myself in. So I came back on a Thursday to a different meeting, and I came down these stairs, I can't remember how many, 13, 14 stairs, and people are in there, and the room is really noisy, and people are laughing, and I'm like, well, clearly they haven't had the hard life that I've had. They can't know my pain. And so they went around, and I thought, whoever was chairing, I thought, oh, they're the president. They must be the president all the time. So I need to be really careful around there, because I didn't know it, but authority figures scared the crap out of me, right? So people went around one person at a time and told their story. And I just, my jaw hit the floor. The first story was like, oh my goodness, I can relate so much to that. The circumstances, not exactly, but feelings, even though I don't know how to feel feelings, but I'm like, I think that's what I would feel if I could feel. And by the third person, I was just like, oh my goodness, I'm home. I found my people. Like, I've searched for you guys my whole life. There was pre-meeting, when I was sitting there waiting, they had an opening and they had the 12 steps and the 12 traditions on the inside. So I was reading them so I didn't have to look at anyone, and so nobody would talk to me. And I remember seeing one of the steps, I think it was step 5, and I was admitted to God to another human being and myself, the exact nature of my wrongs. And I had remembered some stuff that I had done. And I thought, no one will ever know about that. I will take that stuff to my grave. I cannot tell anyone. Like, if they found out what I had done, they would know what a monster I am, and they'd run away screaming. And so the meeting ended. There were people hugging. I couldn't hug anyone. I was just too emotionally, physically intimate. Like, intimacy, I was an intimacy cripple. I just could not hug them. And over time, they started going for coffee, and they invited me to coffee, and I was like too scared to go. But eventually, after a couple months, I got brave enough to go for coffee. And coffee's turned out to be more valuable to me than the meeting itself. I got to ask people questions one-on-one, so I could ask and they'd give me a direct answer. Or if they didn't feel comfortable, they'd just say, I don't feel comfortable talking about that with you. And it was so different from the home life I had grown up in. But that's what I needed. That's what I wanted, even though I was scared. So I had come in April, and in October, I went into a deep, deep depression. Because I would hear people tell their stories, and they'd have all these feelings they talked about. These feelings would trigger in me. And it was just like me standing at the bottom of the Hoover Dam and the dam breaking, and like all of my feelings that I'd stuffed, that I'd kept in, all of them were happening at the same time. But I didn't know how to cry yet. I still wasn't crying. I still couldn't even express it. I could parrot what people said, but I couldn't connect what I was saying. Like, I feel sad, but I couldn't connect it to my heart. And so I was still intellectually using like pseudo feelings. I was naming them, parroting, saying all the right things, but not knowing how to feel. And so I went into this super deep depression. I missed all of the meetings in October. I just slept 8, went to work. I got up at 7, went to work at 8, finished work at 5, 8, and by 7 o'clock I was back in bed sleeping for 12 hours. So when I finished that October depression, I came back and I was like, okay, if you can't beat them, you might as well join them. And I was more determined to figure out how to do this program. There were other outside programs, self-development courses that I took because everybody else was taking them. Well, I shouldn't say everybody. There were some people taking them, and I decided, yeah, I'm going to do them. They gave me all kinds of tools, but I didn't know how to use them. It was just too much too fast. So I had done adult children. I went into service not the first year. I think I chaired a meeting my first year, and that was all I could do for service. And then the second year to about the 8th year, I did 7 years in a row of service. And some of my reasons for doing service were I couldn't say no, so I was people-pleasing other people that would ask. The arrogance I have, this meeting is going to end if I don't take over the group rep position interim. No one will survive without me. I'm so amazing that they can't live without me. And then I served as the adult child area coordinator for my province in Saskatchewan here. And that was for power. People treated me differently. When I got into that position, I spoke at tons of roundups. I spoke at all of the Al-Anon kind of like fall and spring service meetings. Any Al-Anon function I spoke at, and people treated me like royalty. It was different. I've heard AA speakers on the AA circuit, they get addicted to speaking on the circuit because people think, oh, you guys know everything and you're working this solid program, but they're not. They're just telling a really great story. So I eventually retired from service and took a break because I was also burnt out. So I went to, there were 5 adult children meetings in my city at one point in time, like all in person. There was ACA, which I didn't go to because somebody had said, well, it was really good, but then they got into a fight over Melody Beattie, or I think it was John Gray at the time. There was no big red book at the time, so they fought over literature, and the person just said, they're kind of, yeah, not doing well right now. There was a Christian ACA meeting, but I wasn't religious, so I didn't go to that. And then there were 3 AAC, Al-Anon Adult Child meetings. All of them died. All of them died within a period of like 2 or 3 years. I would go to a meeting and there'd be nobody that wanted to chair. There'd be like 5 of us. And so I'd chair a meeting once a week. I chaired over 150 meetings. And then there was no adult child meetings at all. So I went to regular Al-Anon and did that for a number of years. I got married to someone from AAC. I had seen her. She was the first woman I was ever attracted to. She had done modeling, but she'd been through a nervous breakdown, and I didn't know what that meant. But we talked, we were friends for 11 months, and I felt so ugly on the inside and on the outside. Growing up, the girls on the playground made sure I knew I was ugly. I'd go to ask them a question. They're like, I don't want to go out with you. I'm like, I'm just asking a question. And so because I had no self-worth, no self-esteem, and I felt unlovable, it was like, I must be like, I am ugly on the inside and ugly on the outside. So when I saw this woman in AAC that was beautiful to me, I was friends with her for 11 months, but I was really attracted to her. And she told me strange things. She had been in Vancouver, came back here. And she told me strange things like emotions and holding them within could cause disease, right? And I'm like, that, I just didn't believe that at all. But I really wanted to sleep with her. So I just said, oh, really? Okay. So I was friends. We got married. It was a tumultuous relationship. I didn't know it, but she had had a paranoid schizophrenic breakdown. Her mom had taken her to 5 doctors. The first 4 said she had paranoid schizophrenia. The 5th one said, oh, no, she's just malnourished, right? So I thought if I had a beautiful woman on my arm, other women would see me as having some value. Other men would envy me. I would have value and worth. But it was all just in my head, right? It was just, yeah, madness, my own madness. And so we eventually got married. And even though I knew the marriage wouldn't work based on how tumultuous our relationship was, car door slamming, Raylene getting out of the car and walking home, me driving beside her, begging her to get back in. And we got married, moved out to the farm where I am now. And we did our best, but I was angry, right? I had all this anger inside, and Raylene was a safe person for me. So I wanted love and intimacy more than anything, but I didn't know how to take it. I didn't know how to receive it. I could give it when I wanted something, but I didn't know how to give it unconditionally because I didn't love myself. And so I did what my dad did. I would scream and yell at her. She would scream and yell back. We'd have a big fight. And then there'd be the lull, the roller coaster, and then it would begin again. I was groundhog for 7 years. Eventually I got into a fight with her where I wanted to kick her out. And I don't know how she knew it, but she sensed it. And she didn't talk to me for a week. And then, like, I kept saying, I'm ready to talk, I'm ready to talk. And she wouldn't talk to me. And then she said, I'm leaving. And so we had a 5-month separation. She came back for maybe 3 or 4 months. and it was just too far gone. There was so much damage. We talked and we just said, we've got so much baggage together. We've hurt each other. It would be easier to just start again with somebody else. So we went our separate ways, and it was, yeah, it was heartbreak. I finally got to cry the way I needed to cry. But it was at the expense of a relationship. And yeah, she moved to Manitoba, the next province over. She still had three really great friends at my Al-Anon meeting, and so I would hear about Raylene's awesome wedding, and it was like, oh, my heart just ached for that. But there was a 12-year gap before I saw her again. So let's see, meeting is being recorded, and okay, so I can see there was time up. I think I'm at 15 minutes, somewhere around there. So I was in Al-Anon. I saw this friend from Al-Anon that had been in Al-Anon for many, many years, and they were kind of at a plateau. And then I watched them just magically fast forward in their recovery. Like, they were on a rocket sled, and I couldn't believe it. So I asked them, like, what are you doing that's so different from, like, regular Al-Anon? And they said, I'm going to Adult Children of Alcoholics. It's a step meeting. And I said, oh, can I join? And it's like, no, it's women only. And I'm like, oh, disappointment. That's okay. She said, but we're thinking about getting a meeting going. We're thinking about having an open meeting, like a co-ed meeting open. And it'll be 4 or 5 months from now. It'll be next year, right? So come January, the meeting started. It was just at somebody's house. There was maybe 7 of us. And it was pretty remarkable. I'd never, ever heard readings from the Big Red Book or daily affirmations, anything like any of the literature from ACA. One of the people that was there at my first Al-Anon Adult Children meeting, who had, like, I think 7 years before me, they gave me photocopied pictures of Step 1 and 2. And I read Step 1 and 2, Chapters 1 and 2 on Steps 1 and 2. And it knocked me on my ass. I had never read anything so comprehensive and describing me so well. She'd given me up to Step 3, and I couldn't read 3. I was just too overwhelmed with everything that had happened. And so I kept going to the meetings. I had a sponsor left over from Al-Anon Adult Children, and the AAC, like the ACA meetings were pretty remarkable. So I kept going to them. COVID happened. We still met at somebody who was a dual member, like AA and ACA. And so we had meetings in their backyard, and we had the dual meeting. And I took on one of their sponsees, and it was an interesting relationship. Like, the person could not look me in the eye. They couldn't look anyone in the eye. So I said, like, are they autistic? And the sponsor said, I don't know. So I looked up autism, and then I'm like, oh my goodness, I have like 3/8 of the symptoms of autism. So I'm more than likely on the spectrum, and my humor is often just a little too far out for people. So, you know, that's the way it goes, but I do my best. And so I came to a place where I had done step meetings in Al-Anon Adult Children. There was a purple book called A Way Out, and there's an eye icon with feet on it, and it was really cool. But I had the version before, which was the clown coming out of the jack-in-box, and it was really scary. Nobody got the memo that clowns are scary. So I did those 12 steps, and they were grueling. I dropped out the first time. It took me another 4 years before I got a relationship with a power greater than myself. And then I was able to do the steps with a group. And because I'm a sex addict, I, of course, was the only male left with 4 females. And it's exactly what I needed. The monster I thought I was, they listened, and nobody ran away. Nobody screamed, People still hugged me, and we were still connected from that step group. So when I was in ACA, I would travel with people in the other program, but it was always so superficial. Like, I didn't let anyone know who I truly was. My heart wasn't in it. And so I looked good on the outside in program. Like, I'm still trying to manage looking good. And 5.5 years ago, I got to a place where I just surrendered. And I said, okay, God, I'll work with other people in earnest. And I had a true surrender, like the surrender where I came to adult children the first time. That was my first surrender. And it took 27 years before I surrendered again. And so when I did the surrendering again, 2.5 weeks later, the person who had meetings in their backyard, they phoned me up and they say, hey, I've got this guy from New York and ACA. They want a sponsor, but they don't want a hard-nosed, hardcore AA sponsor that grinds them, right? They need somebody gentle. And I thought of you. And I was like, oh, okay. If they had seen me at my worst, they probably wouldn't have thought of me, but I'd done some work in that time. So I talked to the New York guy, and I had had a history of telling people everything about me, even though I'd only known them for 2 days. And when I'm at a workplace, oh my goodness, all of these deep, dark secrets that I tell them pretty soon are going around the workplace. And it's like, oh, I can't trust anyone. Gee, but I didn't look at myself. I didn't look at how I abandoned myself. And so the New York guy, we overshared, but we connected on such a deep level. We're still traveling together to this day. So then that was December. Then in January, I got a second person. I said, like, how do you work Tony A's 12 steps on feelings? Like, I know how to do it through the old style ACA steps, but I don't know how to do it with Tony A's steps. Tony A's steps look way too gentle to me. I'm like, how could anyone recover from these? And so the guy asked, he said, well, why don't we do the steps? Because it's not really a two-sentence answer. I'm like, oh, okay. So I started traveling with a second person. By the end of January, I had a third person that asked me to travel with him. So I did the Tony A's 12 steps. And what I thought were steps that were inadequate, that were too easy, too soft, too gentle, turned out to be the deepest, most loving steps I've ever done. I got to go deeper than I've ever gone inside of myself. My core beliefs that I'm unlovable, that I don't deserve anything, and I'm unworthy were revealed to me in doing those 12 steps. Sharing the 14 traits, the 28 traits, and then having three more on top of that that were my own personal ones was amazing. People-pleasing is the trait that I still go to and still gets me in trouble to this day. I've had a number of fellow travelers that I've ended. I've had more come in. I've been people-pleasing. I blew up at a traveler 3 times in 22 months. They ended the relationship with me. And I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Like, 3 strikes and you're out. So it was like, yeah, they deservedly did what was best for them. And so I needed to look at my behavior, and this people-pleasing just keeps coming up. Combined with fawning, my people-pleasing gets me in trouble. When I listen to somebody as a fellow traveler, if I listen to them complain, I suggest, well, complaining isn't really recovery. It just keeps me in a stuck place, right? It's part of the problem instead of the solution. And the other person can't really hear me. And so I don't say anything after that, and I let it build up and build up and build up, and then I explode. And then it's like, oh, well, I didn't want to say anything because I was afraid if I said something, they would stop loving me and have nothing to do with me and end the relationship. But that's what happens in the end anyway when I abandon myself. And so I just, yeah, that's the one that I keep going to. That's the one that I keep having the most problems with. And that's what I need to keep working on and be aware of. And it's very humbling. It's very humbling when it's like, oh, wow, Another relationship has ended because I'm not speaking up for myself. I'm abandoning myself. When I was briefly married for that time, my wife was the first one to ever ask me. Thank you very much, Rich. I hear that. My wife was the first one who ever said to me, like, how have you abandoned yourself? And that was, like, not part of the AAC program at all. So it really surprised me to hear that, but it's taken me a long time to hear those things. If I could go back in time and tell my 26-year-old self the three things to focus on, I would go with deep breathing, silence and meditation, and fellow travelers. Out of those three things, I found my higher power as a result of that. The deep breathing, when I was 26 and I heard people talk about breathing, I'm like, oh, I think I got this. I'm 26. I've made it this far. I think I'm okay. I don't need your help. And 6 years ago, I started deep breathing in a way that I'd never been able to deep breathe before. The first 2 weeks, my lungs felt like I'd been hit with a baseball bat because I had never used my lungs to such a depth to fill them. They stretch muscles, and it was like, oh my goodness, wow. The deep breathing led me to meditation. Meditation to me was always the, like, someone, a yogi going om. And so that's what I found. Wayne Dyer's Getting Into the Gap had the om stuff. So I did that for 10 years, I think 9. I just did it exactly the way it is because I'm a rule follower, don't you know? And you got to follow the rules. So I did it exactly as the meditation said. So in the 10th year, I started playing with the ohms. Instead of just doing it and copying it the way Wayne Dyer did, I started doing it like opera and just doing my own thing. And I found that I had certain frequencies that were vibrating in a way that were very harmonious for my own self. And so I got to a place where I would sit in silence. That was the next part of my meditation. Somebody said, well, you can have your eyes open for meditation. You don't have to do it before you're falling asleep. And you can be outside. And so I was meditating. I dropped into what I call the here and now. Everything slows down. Everything is so vibrant and amazing. It's like the land of what I thought people, I would call them people from the land of woo or woo woo, because it was so strange, but yet here it is happening to me. And this is just the stuff that's woo-woo that has happened to me through meditation. I can't even say because it sounds crazy even to me still. So, and then fellow travelers have helped me so much. I had someone that I traveled with recently that didn't tell me they had mental illness until the 7th month. And it took me another 15 months to realize I needed to get out. But coincidentally, they had the exact same mental illness as my little brother. And I was like, oh, so I guess I still have some unresolved issues with my little brother. and crying 2 years ago, well, yeah, 2 years ago, I was in a place where I lost my daughter through custody. And then my ex had decided to not let me have access to my daughter. I didn't feel the pain like 2 Christmases ago, but there's a lot of people in this room that helped me get through it at that time. The next Christmas is when all the pain came, and I cried and cried and cried over my daughter for, I don't know, the day 6 before Christmas, day 4, I cried over my dad and my mom, and then on the day before, on the 23rd of December, I cried over being left alone in the room as a baby for my first 2 years. The depth of the crying, it's like when I lose all ego, when I'm crying, I'm heaving, snot's running down my face, and I go into the fetal position. That's when I know it's genuine. That's when I know I've let go of ego for that time. And what was my worst case thing, my daughter being taken out of my life, turned out to be the best thing that has ever happened to me. I've been able to get to a depth of feeling that I've never gotten to before. It's been amazing. It's been remarkable. And I keep seeing what I perceived as something happening to me is now I'm perceiving my higher power has been doing it for me. and it's a different place to be. I still make mistakes. My life is still a mess, but I keep coming back because there's just nothing else like it. Thank you very much. Thoughts, comments, and questions all welcome.